Support for the full story comes from Yale New Haven Health, joining the public and expressing thanks and gratitude to their nurses, doctors, and all healthcare workers who are doing extraordinary things for everyone. YaleNewHavenHealth.org.
This is the full story. I'm Tom Kuser. The United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world. About 2 million people were detained in the nation's prisons and jails in 2020. But this condition goes deeper. According to the Prison Policy Initiative, a nonprofit, nonpartisan research advocacy group, this is a quote, every single U.S. state incarcerates more people per capita than virtually any independent democracy on earth. Even progressive states like Connecticut, with incarceration rates below the national average, continue to lock up people at more than double the rates of our closest international allies like the United Kingdom, Portugal, and Canada. End quote there. The initiative also says the U.S. incarcerates more of its population than nations with similar or even higher crime rates. Advocates suggest that the incarceration rates aren't really about crime rates, but an easy response to public fears and perceptions about crime and a reliance on policing to deal with social problems that could be solved with policy rather than prison. Before we can engage in prison reform and transforming criminal justice, do we need to change our perceptions of them? And is one way to do that by reading works by incarcerated people about their experience? Two professors from LaGuardia Community College have written a book that offers a distinctive perspective on this idea. Dr. Joni Schwartz-Cheney is a professor of communication studies in the Department of Humanities at LaGuardia Community College, the City University of New York, and an adjunct professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice Graduate Studies Program. And Professor John Cheney is an associate professor and criminal justice program co-director, also at LaGuardia Community College. Professor Schwartz-Cheney, welcome.
Thank you.
And Professor Cheney, welcome to The Full Story. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, to be here. Thank you so much for having us on the air.
Oh, certainly. The title of your book really sets the tone for the content, I think. Gifts from the Dark, Learning from the Incarceration Experience. What motivated you both to write the book?
Well, meeting people. Individuals who had been incarcerated, working in the prisons, had met so many people who then came out and had so much to offer. They had been transformed. Not everyone, but there had been transformative learning. And they had come out with riches, in a sense, gifts, that I think that we can all benefit and learn from, because, in a sense, we're all imprisoned by something.
At the end of the day, we definitely realize that the perception that we are offering is not one that is of common knowledge or not one that is commonly disseminated, to the general public. The fact that as formidable and as negative an experience that prison actually is, that within the proper circumstances and the proper types of resources within, we have seen some amazing, amazing success stories that have to do with if prison exists, that we definitely do have a major interest in deciding what is there that can actually help the individual to actually become an asset to the community and actually transform. And we wanted to make sure that this message became clear.
Professor Schwartz-Cheney, you use the term transformative learning. Prison can be a place of transformative learning. What do you mean exactly by that?
Yeah, coming from adult education and the learning of adults, right? And how from Freire, Mesereau, that term comes. And it is the idea that we actually change life perspective and that we grow, we develop emotionally, intellectually, with our habits. So there is a general change of life view that then comes out in your actions. So it is a whole person kind of change.
And prison is a very, very unlikely place where people would expect to see such a transformation. We wanted to put a lot of highlight. We wanted to highlight this fact because we do feel that, especially the some of the statistics that you highlighted earlier in the broadcast, that these very instances of transformation can also be some very formidable tools in reversing some of the mass incarceration statistics and reversing some of the trends that we've seen in the past that have to do with mass incarceration and disparities in prison.
And recidivism.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
There's a quote, too, I think that speaks to something you you mentioned a few minutes ago, Professor John Chaney. Again, a quote. The central theme of the book is to, quote, uncover the unexpected jewels that have been found amid the madness. Could you share a specific example with us?
Oh, my goodness. I'd be happy to. First of all, as you also saw, what the book does not do is glorify glorify the prison experience. If anything, we do feel the whole prison structure, there is major reform that needs to be undertaken immediately. There are a few things there are a few policy changes that have resulted in some of the decline in the prison population. However, having said that, we actually have witnessed, and as you probably saw, chapter one of our book highlights some of the remarkable success stories in terms of people who, in spite of the trauma, and in spite of the madness, in spite of some of the obstacles, the formidable obstacles that one will find within the dangers and confines of the incarceration experience, we found some folks who actually have superseded that a situation that would normally be one that would result in a person's, if anything, deterioration, and they have actually been able to thrive, and upon release have actually become assets to the community. We have a number of people that have become great writers, great community organizers, and of course, as you probably saw, the book highlights some key profiles of some individuals that have come from our state and federal facilities.
Right. From a historical perspective, we take it in the beginning of the book, you know, throughout history, this is true. And then we bring it down later in the book. You know, we talk about the prison tradition, Gromsky, and we talk about Viktor Frankl, and we talk about Nelson Mandela and Assata Shakur, Jack Henry Abbott, very different prisoners, but their transformation and how they gave to the world. So we begin there. And then through the book, we talk about people now. And I guess you asked about particular people who've had that experience. I'll mention just one I actually met a couple of days ago in my office. He is a gentleman that just graduated from LaGuardia Community College. He's going on to a four-year college. He intends to be a lawyer. And he went into prison when he was a teenager and spent 25 years and came out and is now, you know, grappling with adjusting, certainly, to coming socialization and that kind of thing, and especially with COVID. But he's gone through, and he's in terms of his academic career, he's on his way.
Guess from the Dark actually does highlight many of these lesser known individuals or unknown individuals who the public does not see. Public very rarely hears about them unless you're in the business of prisoner reentry or criminal justice. And just yesterday, I unfortunately left a funeral involving one of our reentry giants, an individual who himself had began his life with a history of involvement in the criminal justice system, did spend some time in prison. His name is William Whitaker. And William actually became one of the giants of prison reform and human rights for individuals who had issues of incarceration or substance abuse. And our book does have a number of individuals like William, you know, highlighted, you know, just so that the public knows that you don't necessarily have to be famous to be an asset to the community.
One of the writers that you mentioned in the book, and a few moments ago you talked about writers who have been in prison, Viktor Frankl, you mentioned Nelson Mandela, and you also mention Chester B. Himes,
yes,
a contemporary of James Baldwin, Richard Wright. didn't achieve that same notoriety. Could you tell us something about Chester Himes?
Well, he grew up in the urban environment, and he wrote a lot of urban plays and novels, street stories, that kind of thing. And he left the United States and lived in Europe. But I think there has been some revival of his work. And now a lesser known African-American writer, and he wrote out of his experience in prison and the trauma of watching an inmate get murdered. And he wrote out of that pain. And this whole tradition of writers and prison writing is amazing. We make the case in the book that we think that more universities should have courses specifically in prison writing, because it is an amazing genre, and people in prison write prolifically.
Why is it important for us to know the stories of someone like Chester Himes? We, as I mentioned before, we certainly know the stories, the writings of James Baldwin and Richard Wright. Why is it important to know about the stories that people like Chester Himes have written?
Those are called counter stories, right? When we talk about critical race theory, which of course is another whole topic, but when we talk about critical race theory, it talks about counter stories, telling the stories that don't get told, that telling a story from a different perspective, and seeing the world through people who maybe have not been as privileged and not from a white perspective. And that's why we need to hear these stories. We need to understand that the world is not the same for all of us, and that it also will show disparity, but it also shows the richness of other people's life's experience.
It also gives a major red flag or a major analysis to the fact that for the average person who sees and understands that there are sometimes often positive outcomes that special individuals can achieve while they're in prison, it will make the average person a little bit more aware that they should have some understanding or should have some concern for the conditions of our prisons as they exist. Because if you really are very concerned about like long-term public safety and long-term quality of life, well, then when you see examples of the individuals that we exemplify in our book, then you will understand that it depends so much upon what you decide, you know, as a voter and as a member of the public, what kind of condition, what types of resources and services that are available in your institution. This may have the outcome that will eventually reduce recidivism amongst the people that are there. So it also does that.
And despite prisonization, we talk about the process of prisonization, right? Despite the horrors of prison, the tragedies of prison, the violence of prison, despite that, there people write, they read so much, they, without technology, they have an ability to do deep work. They exercise. Some people, despite all of the suffering that is prison, find ways to live, if I might say, richly within this terrible environment.
And having done that, upon release, they bring these new qualities and these new skills and this enhanced discipline to the world. And this is the reason why we call our book Gifts from the Dark. These are gifts that should be acknowledged and utilized by the community. And this basically means that you really do want to understand and open your ears to what stories that these amazing individuals who circumvented these horrors of prison, what they have to say, what they have to tell, and more importantly, what they have to offer the world.
I'm speaking with Professors Joni Schwartz-Chaney and John Chaney, both teachers at LaGuardia Community College, part of the City University of New York, about the book Gifts from the Dark, Learning from the Incarceration Experience. Professor Chaney, Would you share your own experience as well here today? How did you find writing in prison?
Okay, it was definitely a transformative act for me, although I did not see it at the time. Just for the benefit of your our listeners, I should let them know that my time in prison took place maybe in the 90s, and it ended in early 2000. 2003, I was released from prison because of issues that I had involving substance abuse. Upon my release is when I began to utilize the transformative skills and tools that I had acquired, but I began very, very much with the foundation of introspection through writing. This is an ongoing theme. This seems to be a commonality of all of the writers that we highlight in the early chapters in our book. And I could certainly say that when I sat down in my cell and began to try to get deeper into myself, as Dr. Schwartz mentioned, deep work and deep introspection, I would put these on paper. And this was the beginning of my having a much better understanding of who I was, why I fell into some of the traps that I fell into. And it was the very beginning of my healing process. And this is not anything that is unique or new to me. We have many, many amazing examples of that, you know, of individuals, men and women, actually, who have taken the time to sit down with their pen and their paper in their cells or sometimes in the library. And the writing is very cathartic. It's very, very much a healing process.
Is the writing then meant to reach that goal, become part of a healing process? Or is it meant to share stories that help people understand what's going on, or perhaps both?
I would say emphatically both. It doesn't always begin with that twofold goal. Sometimes it does. But for the most part, I would say that early on in a person's incarcerative experience, for at least speaking for a number of people that I've met, you know, during my journey, sometimes it's simply to escape the boredom of incarceration and to try to see to what extent that you can kind of sometimes even create stories. And we find a lot of, as you saw with Chester Himes and with individuals, you know, that we highlight in our book, sometimes you try your hand at fiction. Other times you're becoming very introspective and you're looking at yourself like Viktor Frankl did. And it may just begin just as a one-on-one soul searching kind of an endeavor. And before you know it, you're reading what you have and you say, my goodness, you know what? I think that I would like to let my family know or my friends know something about what's going on and has been going on inside me. And many of these have resulted in bigger and better things that have been shared with the world, especially in recent years with a lot of the work that's coming from some of the women's prisons as well. They have some amazing stories as well.
Yeah, I teach a writing class at Queensborough Correctional Facility, which is right across the street from LaGuardia.
Yes.
And in this writing class, people come, they have through the years, some of them spend numbers of years in prison, and they have collections of short stories, screenplays, novels, poetry,
yes,
as well as journaling and other types of writing. So it's really not rare to see people have put together a whole collection, and many of them do want to publish. Many of them want to see other people hear their life, their experiences.
Is it challenging? Is it difficult to get people who haven't shared the experience of prison? Is it challenging to get them to value what you're talking about people have learned while in that situation?
Yes, I think people think of people in prison or have come from prison within the criminal justice system as through a deficit lens, through a deficit model, that they are less than, they are criminals still. They are, you know, there are people who say to me even, aren't you afraid to go in there? I'm asked strange questions like that. And yeah, there's a lot of misconceptions about who people are who have a prison experience. And even those who come out, we still know that there's discrimination in regard to employment and how people view. The gentleman I spoke about that I spoke with a few days ago said, socialization, that the women that he's dating, once they find out that he has spent 25 years in, they look at him differently. So he's struggling with relationships that people don't understand that many of the individuals have been transformed.
The news media, the 6 o'clock news, the web streams, these are formidable adversaries. We need them, of course. At the same time, Willie Lee getting his GED, Jenny Jones getting, not having committed any crimes for the last 2 years after her release. This does not make news. What makes news are the latest major violent news that involves someone coming from prison or parolee. This is what sticks in the heads of individuals. So irrespective of the fact that you may have 80% or 70% of individuals that come out, maybe get involved in programs and you never hear from them again, what people remember is the latest headline. We're going through something like that right now as we speak, as a matter of fact, because of although we've had juveniles crime way, way down, the fact that we had an incident recently in Brooklyn, New York, involving some juvenile vandalism, this is what sticks in people's heads, not the majority of people who do well. So in that sense, it is very difficult. It's an ongoing job to keep people abreast of the fact that reform works, reentry works, and that we do have some people that are coming out of prison who are doing some amazing, wonderful things. But we need to get the public on board with more public education about this.
Do those attitudes within the public at large really put up an obstacle to transforming the prison system into something that's more of a reformation process as opposed to a punishment process?
The most recent example that I have encountered or have observed over that in the last, say, 10 years or so has to do with the very interesting discussion and the dilemma of providing college education inside prisons. Now, if you look at the statistics of individuals who are incarcerated, who actually do receive the advantage of a college education, and they actually may be able to receive an associate's, often sometimes bachelor's and master's degrees, the statistics and even the budgets are so clear that you're never going to hear from these individuals again upon release, because now they engage in the workforce. The education has opened up new markets of opportunity for them. However, if you look at what the public, some of the public, well, what their response would be to individuals incarcerated receiving a free education. What? A free education? I had to take out a second mortgage on my house. I had to get a loan. I'm still paying back money. Why should I let convicted felons get a free education? In that sense, there has been enough pushback where now we're beginning to see a little bit more of an enlightened perspective with this. And we do have some amazing programs that have come to the fore, programs like the Barred Prison Initiative and the prison to a college pipeline. However, and continues to be an ongoing struggle to make sure that we are able to show that these initiatives are not only are they cost effective, because it costs a lot less money to get to have free prison and college than it costs to incarcerate someone for a year, but it's also public safety effective, because we're cutting down on recidivism rates.
Right. Restoration of the Pell Grant has been going on. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You write that, this is a quote, the United States is at the intersection of mass incarceration and the prison industrial complex coming out of the war on drugs, and that war was fought primarily in poor neighborhoods, end quote. And you point out that this transition is occurring while the nation is also reeling from a pandemic, the George Floyd murder, and now the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But you are optimistic. You remain optimistic. You suggest that we as a country can evolve together. How can our country really accomplish that, would you say?
Well, I think we know what to do in terms of prison reform. I don't think there's any secrets as to what works and what is helpful and what changes can be made. It's really, is there the will to do it? And that, I think, is a major question. We are hopeful because I think we know what works. And we have seen enough transformation to understand that. But I think that it's more about the will of us to do what works.
And relatively recently also, we saw one of the most unlikely events in Washington, D.C. It didn't really mean, it didn't have a huge impact nationally on the issue of mass incarceration, but it was definitely a very, very positive and symbolic movement or symbolic activity, which had to do with the First Step Act signing, which came, of all places, in a bipartisan meeting of the Trump administration, where you had a large, large number of individuals from both cross sections of society. You had persons from captains of industry standing next to people who were formerly incarcerated. You had Democrats, Republicans. You had celebrities there. You had athletes there. And the event itself, the First Step Act itself, which of course has to do with trying to begin a systemic reform of some of the early release mechanisms in the federal system, that didn't have a huge impact, of course, on our situation at large, because the majority of people, of course, that are in prison in the United States are under the state system. But it showed you for one of the very first times that you actually do have an understanding that what's going on in terms of decarcerating and taking a much more enlightened and smarter look at crime, that this involves not just law enforcement, it involves all of us. So one of the things that it did do was it kind of opened up the idea that people are beginning to understand that no matter what your walk of life is, this does concern you. So in that sense, we have at least a small ray of optimistic light that when you see these stories on television or on a radio or streaming, that you don't just turn the page because you're not a cop or you're not a victim of crime. You are a community person, and all of these things do impact you in some form or fashion. So we do have signs like that that give us a reason to feel that we do have some better things to come, some better expectations to come with respect to our system.
And didn't we see yesterday, John, about the marijuana that in New York State, I think that people who were convicted of—
You actually have to have a conviction, a record of conviction for having marijuana in order for you to qualify for a license now to be a part of this new burgeoning marijuana sales industry in New York State.
That's a positive step. Those people are given a first preference, I think, or will be,
And of course, that not many years ago, that by itself would bar you from a lot of opportunities. So that's one very encouraging step in the right direction.
Professors Joni Schwartz-Cheney and John Cheney, both teachers at LaGuardia Community College, part of the City University of New York, and the authors of the book Gifts from the Dark, Learning from the Incarceration Experience. Thank you both so much for being with us here today and sharing your unique perspectives on this topic. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
We really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Connecticut has taken steps to change its own system of incarceration. Earlier this year, the state's Board of Pardons and Paroles commuted the sentences of 11 men. They had committed crimes when they were 25 years old or younger. The board members say they based their decision on a new understanding in the science of brain development. Joining me now is Kellen Lyons. He's a Report for America Corps member with the Connecticut Mirror, and he wrote an in-depth article about this shift in sentencing. And Kellen joins me via Zoom. Kellen, hello and welcome to The Full Story.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You point out in your article that there were two changes that led to the 11 men having their sentences commuted. First, a law passed in Connecticut in 2015 that ended life without parole sentences. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. So that was an attempt in 2015 to not allow young people who commit certain crimes to spend the rest of their lives in prison. And by young people, I'm referring specifically to children, those under age 18. They can get what is called a juvenile parole hearing. So if they're convicted of very, very, very serious crimes like murder or arson, things of that nature, they have an opportunity to get a parole hearing at some point in their sentence. Whereas in a way that if they were before that law, they would have had to do pretty much all of their time. it was an effort to essentially acknowledge that children in the system are perhaps a little less criminally culpable in the commission of their crimes because they are minors at the time that they commit their crimes, and they're more susceptible to peer pressure. They are impulsive, and they don't think through their decisions in the same way that an adult would.
And what about the pushback back then to that change?
So that was before my time here in Connecticut. So I didn't report on that, but I mean, I can say seeing that in the present day, I mean, there's an ongoing conversation between legislators on how to deal with juvenile crime more broadly. And I think that ultimately what that's coming down to is this tension over holding children accountable versus trying to provide services for them. The juvenile parole decision or that law was more an effort to essentially make sure that somebody didn't spend the rest of their lives in prison because of a crime they committed before they turned 18. And I think you're starting to see the spirit of that in this late, in that round of commutations as well, just for a little bit older of a cohort, because our understanding of brain development has advanced since that time.
And the second change was a growing acceptance that brain development continues until the age of 25. Can you talk a bit more about what you discovered in your reporting regarding the role that played?
Yeah, I think pretty much, I think everybody who has had a sentence commuted at this point, and there have been a dozen of them in total since the new round of criteria came out, the new criteria eligibility, everybody was 25 or younger at the time. And that reflects this increasing consensus among criminal justice stakeholders that brain development continues until the age of 25. Just because you turn 18 and you are technically an adult does not necessarily mean that you are more adult than you were, you know, age 17 at 364 days. The latest on juvenile brain science suggests that brain development continues until 25. And until then, teenagers are processing information with a different part of the brain. They're processing emotion with the emotional part. Adults are processing more with the rational part of their mind. And so the Board of Pardons and Parole is recognizing that science and is saying that perhaps those who committed crimes between the ages of 18 and 25 would have a sentence that is different now than they would at the time they were sentenced. What they're essentially saying is that the contemporary sentencing practices are a little bit different than they were at the time these individuals were sentenced. Many of these men have spent more time incarcerated, they've spent more time in prison than the age at which they were originally locked up. You know, some of them have been in there for 20 years or so, 30 years or so. And so the board is essentially saying, perhaps these men could be given a chance to get out a little early and to try to put their lives back together within the community.
So what happens when the parole board commutes a sentence?
So the parole board hasn't commuted a sentence outright, by which I mean they haven't literally said you're going to go home today. Mm-hmm. They've been really careful not to just have someone leave, walk out the front door. I mean, these are all of them have been men so far, although the other day they did advance a few women to a commutation hearing down the line. All these men have done significant periods of time in prison, and life has changed. I mean, 20, 30 years ago, life is significantly different than it was. Like many of them, think about the internet, think about social media. I mean, these are things that these guys only kind of understood from incarceration. So the board has commuted these sentences to be essentially eligible for some form of supervised release. The Connecticut Department of Corrections screens people for a form of supervised release when they have about 18 months left on their sentence. So the board has been cutting sentences short enough that they're in that 18-month range, and then the DOC can send them to a halfway house or somewhere else to be supervised. Or they have cut those sentences to be eligible for a parole hearing of some sort, whether it's a juvenile parole hearing or a compassionate parole hearing, in which case a different part of the Board of the Pardons and Paroles would screen these folks for that form of release. All of which is to say, it gets really complicated when you're talking about what kind of release someone can get. All of which is to say, the board is just trying to make sure that there's another set of eyes on these guys when they get out, so they're not just released and go home.
So there's a system in place to help them transition back into life outside of prison, or is system too structured a word?
That's the goal. I mean, I think if you talk to the board, they would say that their objective is to make sure that these guys are set up for as much success as possible, meaning they get out and there are folks who are supervising them in the community and trying to make sure that they are, that their reintegration into society is successful. But of course, there are all kinds of challenges for individuals who get out because of the collateral consequences of their convictions. All of these guys are in for, are doing time for murder, felony murder. I mean, they all had many of them had a lot of media focus in their stories when they went into trial, and or if they took a plea deal or media coverage of their crimes. So Googling their names, I mean, more than likely they're going to be found relatively quickly. So of course they will most likely be facing the same challenges that other individuals face when they get out, as far as difficulties in perhaps accessing housing or employment down the line.
Younger than 18 is what we talked about as far as when they were convicted or when the crimes were committed. How young were some of the younger ones? Are there any specific stories you can share?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've heard a lot about individuals who suffered serious trauma before they went inside. There was one individual who was 15 years old when he went in. His family members were scattered, right? And he had parental figures outside the home to some degree. And so he would kind of get help from the local YMCA, but he was getting love and he was getting community from the streets, as he said in his hearing. And when he was 15 years old, he committed a murder and he went to prison, and he's been incarcerated ever since. I mean, you hear a lot of instances of trauma from a lot of these folks. You hear a lot of folks who were suffering with substance abuse problems who have since found recovery since they got incarcerated. You hear about a lot of individuals who got sick when they were incarcerated and who, you know, the first guy who got a commutation, his name was Michael Cox, and he, in many ways, his case showed how serious the Board of Partisan Paroles was taking the commutations process, because this was a man who, he killed two people, he shot a third, and he was responsible for the death of another individual, a string of violent crimes that he committed when he was in his 20s. And he's been incarcerated for 30 years, and he's profoundly sick at this point in his life. And the board ended up cutting his sentence so that he would be eligible for compassionate parole, which is a very narrow law in Connecticut that says that if you have served half of your sentence and you are so sick that you cannot or do not pose a danger to society, you can go home. So they commuted his sentence so that he would be more than halfway through it, and he qualified for compassionate parole and was able to go home. But he was quite a sick man. I mean, he would tell me that he was worried that he was going to die in prison. He told the parole board that he would wake up some nights and think like this was it, and he was never going to get out of that cell. And now he's out, and the last I heard, he was on dialysis. So he is not, it's not as though he got out and he is living a healthy life in a way that he wasn't when he was incarcerated.
I don't know if this was part of your reporting, but I would imagine that those related to the victims of his crimes had an opinion about this.
Yeah, so there is a space for victims to provide input in these hearings. I wouldn't say that they don't say whether or not an individual can get a commutation. I don't think they make or break it in either direction. I mean, I certainly think the board hears them out, but it really speaks to how it opens up old wounds for these victims to come in and talk about these crimes. I mean, all of these crimes were from decades ago. Victims probably spoke up in about half of the cases or so. You know, it's quite clear that it's still traumatic for them to talk about. They've talked about the ways that their lives are still upended, the way that they still miss these loved ones whom they've lost. You know, to me, what it really shows is how violent crimes and violence in general tends to echo across generations. We've heard a lot about how family members, children, who are no longer children at this point, but, you know, they don't have those family members around anymore because they lost their loved one. You know, some have said that they were frustrated because they felt like they were given a promise by the courts that this person would serve this amount of time. But there has been some nuance. There was one person in particular who said that the person who killed, I believe it was her husband, he admitted that he had struggled with substance abuse, and he had since found recovery since getting incarcerated. And she said that she acknowledged that he had played a role in mentoring young people during his time in prison. And, you know, it was clear that she was really struggling with this, even though she was only over a phone call, but she was breaking up, and she was saying, if you can help someone by getting out of here and you can make sure that this doesn't happen again, then I am in favor of your commutation, which is this really powerful, powerful discussion on sort of the role of the that these men might have when they get out. I mean, they may, many of them, if they so choose, they may have an opportunity to make sure that others don't go down the same path that they did, don't cause the same amount of pain that they did. And perhaps they can stop an incidence of violence from echoing across generations in the same way that their crimes continue to do today.
Did the men on the receiving end of the commutations, did they apply for the sentences to be commuted, or did the parole board select them?
They do apply. The Board of Pardons and Paroles had, I think, only 22 applications for their first round of commutations. And the board took their commutations process offline for 2 whole years. And incarcerated folks were very, I had gotten some letters and I had heard some folks who were concerned that they wanted the commutations to come back, because for many people, this is the only way that they can get out of prison. There's about 1,000 people who are incarcerated who are ineligible for some other form of release. So once they opened up the commutation process, they only got about 22 after the first round. And Michael Cox was ultimately the only person whose case was granted. The next round, they got a number of more applications and they granted 11 in total. And then in this last round of commutations, they had a pre-screen the other day and they had 74 people who applied, which was a significant number. The board has made an effort to go into the prisons and to ask individuals, you know, this is something that you can apply for. If you would like to try to get a commutation, submit this application here. This past Tuesday was that commutation pre-screen, and it was quite interesting because there were a lot of people who were considered in that round, and there were 39 denials and 35 people who advanced. Most people were denied because of disciplinary reports. They had gotten kind of disciplinary tickets in the last few years. The board members have been wary of that.
You mean while in prison?
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And there also were a couple people who the board said that there were no extraordinary circumstances in their opinion that would warrant a commutation. Now, what that says to me, given that there was such a wider array of people who were applying to this and a number who were advanced, it says that word is starting to spread among the prisons that this exists as an avenue for release. And so the more and more incarcerated people are applying for this form of release for commutation. And that means there's going to be more denials. I mean, there's going to be more people that the board is going to be uncomfortable commuting. For some of them, they gave them like sort of hints on the record if their lawyers were there, saying like, you're eligible for a juvenile parole hearing in another year or two, take some more rehabilitative programming. But for the most part, they would acknowledge in their denial, they would reference one or two of the criteria or the suitability criteria that the incarcerated had failed to reach before applying.
Each of the people applying for the commutation then would have a lawyer involved in the process?
They can. They don't have to have a lawyer. There have been several individuals who haven't had lawyers, and those have been really, really interesting hearings. I mean, these guys have all done a lot of time, so they have all had a lot of time to think about their crimes and how to frame them. And in fact, many of them tend to file lawsuits themselves, so they're actually pretty well versed in the area of the law that their cases fall on. But it's been interesting to watch some of these folks field questions from the board without a lawyer and then get a commutation.
Kellen Lyons, thanks for your time today and your insights and reporting on this issue. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Kellen Lyons is a Report for America Corps member with the Connecticut Mirror. Morgan Tuck is a former star of UConn women's basketball. She played on 4 consecutive championship teams with the Huskies. She's now the director for franchise development with the WNBA's Connecticut Sun. As part of our Newsmaker series, Morgan Tuck spoke with WSHU's Mike Lyle about social activism in sports.
Morgan, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Recently, you held a presentation at the Lyme Art Association for the Public Art for Racial Justice Education. And you touched on a number of items related to social justice, as well as your employer, the Connecticut Sun. Well, they have a program called Change Can't Wait. Can you expand on what purpose it serves?
Yes, so Change Can't Wait is the Connecticut Sun Social Justice Platform that was started in the summer of 2020. It was started in response to Breonna Taylor and George Floyd and their murders, and just how that kind of had such a big impact on society as a whole. So it was started to really create change. Like, that was the goal behind it. And when I came in and started working for the Sun last June, one of my big tasks was to take Change Can't Wait and kind of revamp it a little bit. And then really put programming and action behind it, instead of just kind of saying all the right things, like to really be out there and kind of doing the work. So that's where Change Can't Wait started from. And Change Can't Wait has four pillars, which is police reform, civic engagement, community advocacy, and then health equity. So now that's what we do. We try to do different programs that fit under each pillar, and that are just out there creating change for, you know, underserved groups in Connecticut.
Well, you have said you were inspired by your former colleague and UConn basketball alumni, Maya Moore, and she stepped back from playing at the peak of her professional career to work on social activism. Why did you find her decision so inspiring?
Well, first, I love Maya Moore. Like, she was someone I love watching, and just kind of, you know, obviously her play on the court, but then, you know, how she carried herself off the court. And then when I got a chance to meet her on one of my first visits to UConn, I was just in awe. Like, she was such a great person. And like, when you see someone in this, and you kind of put them on a pedestal just because of how great they are, but she was a really, really great person. And then so once she really started doing social justice work, she was someone that I really looked up to, because I didn't think at the time that that was something that I would ever be willing to do, right? The way she used her voice. And then when she stepped away from basketball, I was like, I don't think I would ever do that. You know, like, she literally left at the peak of her career. She was one of the best to ever touch a basketball. And she literally put that on the side and in the background because she knew there was a greater cause. So I just thought, you know, the sacrifices that she was willing to make, like, she didn't just say it, she literally lived it, and she made such a big sacrifice. But I don't think without her that professional sports in general would be as far along and have as much to do with social justice if she didn't take the stance that she did.
Well, there are many athletes who are taking risks to bring attention to social justice issues, such as Colin Kaepernick and Naomi Osaka, who publicly addressed the impact of playing professional tennis had on her mental health. And you have members of the Atlanta Dream who took a stand against their owner. So these athletes have been criticized for doing this, though. And I'm just wondering, does it take a stand on an issue such as this to detract from the sport, or is it not about the sport at all?
No, I think it's a little bit of a mix, because it's technically not about the sport, right? Because we're talking about social issues that affect everyone, right? Not just athletes, but I think it takes away from the sport in a sense, because you're using the sport as a platform, but it's not a negative way of taking away from it. But I think the athletes that you just mentioned, they both use their sport and they use the platform that they get through that sport to be able to amplify their voice. And I know a lot of people think that they shouldn't, or like they should just stick to doing their sport or focus, or like, oh, we're watching just to play the sport. We're watching just to see them play their sport, not hear what they have to say. But I think that's the benefit of when you're an athlete, and when you're someone like a Colin Kaepernick, or even though I'm in soccer, right, she was the highest paid female athlete in the world, you know, for like maybe last year, the year before. So someone that, you know, has so much to lose in a sense, for her to use that platform to talk about something that affects so many people, it might take away from people focusing on her playing tennis, but her platform is unmatched. And so to be able to use that through tennis is something that, you know, is kind of priceless.
Well, you took a risk yourself by wearing T-shirts for Breonna Taylor, and she was a Louisville, Kentucky medical worker that was killed by police in the wrongful raid of her home. How did people respond to you when they saw you wearing that shirt?
It was mixed, a very mixed response. I mean, I think the one thing that helped a lot was that we were in the bubble, right? So we didn't have fans, so we didn't have anyone on the outside that was directly there. We didn't have access to fans. We can't walk past them, can't take pictures. We couldn't do any of that. So I think that helped us not get as much negativity that we would have gotten in a normal season. But, you know, it's kind of the same thing where you get some fans that are super supportive, but some that, again, tell you to just go focus on dribbling basketball, right? Like, they're not what they say. They're not here to talk about politics, which, I mean, that's not a political issue. But I think that's kind of the response that you get. But I'd say kind of off of that, Connecticut Sun was the only team in the WNBA last year that knelt for the national anthem. And then now we're back having fans. There's people right there. They're in your face. And so that was we had a lot of really positive support, but we had a lot of negative support. People yelling at the players to stand up. People telling us in the front office, especially me, that like, I need to talk to the players. I need to talk to our president, that the players shouldn't be doing this. So I think it was definitely a mix, but there was definitely some negativity there.
Well, shifting gears a little bit here, and we're going to talk women in sports and equity. And earlier this month, members of the U.S. women's soccer team settled a pay equity lawsuit for $24 million. The majority of that money will go to cover back pay for the players. Is this settlement an admission that women's teams have received unequal compensation for years?
For sure. I think it does 100%. And, you know, even though this is a great win, you know, but it's like, we shouldn't even have to have the win, right? It should have been that way from the beginning, especially when you look at national teams, you know, especially the U.S. Women's soccer team. They're, to me, the more known team, right? They're the ones that they get so much attention. They bring a lot of fans. And so the fact that even a team that gets that attention, gets that TV coverage, is still getting paid less, you know, because that's always the argument is like, oh, well, people don't watch them in sports. They're not as invested. And so they're not going to be able to get paid as much. But that's a team, to me, that shows that that's not true. They get so much support from everyone as a group. And so just to see that, I think it shows women have gotten underpaid for a really long time. And so it's at least nice to see that, you know, some of that tide is turning.
Well, women's teams have had to advocate for not just equal pay, but equal access to training equipment and venues. I mean, we saw in the bubble 2 years ago the conflict between the WNBA and the NBA facilities in Florida, where the NBA had a nice little, looked like it was a paradise compared to what the WNBA was situated with and the conditions that they had down here, which started a little firestorm of, hey, why is it that the NBA players get treated with royalty, but the WNBA players are getting treated like second-class citizens? So that being said, do you think that with all this, are women's athletes being taken more seriously as a result of these issues?
I think it's starting to, like, it's starting to get that way. I can't say that it is 100%, but it's definitely more than what it used to be. But I'm glad the example that you brought up was perfect. And even we look at the NCAA bubbles that they had and the
right
between the men's tournament and women's tournament. And it's like, unfortunately, a lot of us, I would say, we're used to that, right? Like, we're used to it being a little, it's always going to be a little less. That's kind of how it felt. Like, oh, well, it's like we're expected to be grateful for the opportunity, instead of being kind of flip where it's like, okay, let's give them the best experience possible. So I think it's starting to get there. You know, I think if we were to fast forward 10 years, it's going to look a lot different than what it looks like now, but it's not equal, but one day it might be.
Speaking of the women's game, and you being a UConn alum, you've been a member of, I believe, four of the 11 national championships. Now we're seeing the game grown even more. You heard about a certain player named Paige Beckers, who's now back with the Huskies, and now they look like they're a team that's going to make a run towards March and maybe another national championship. How important is it for a name like Paige Beckers to the sport of women's basketball today?
I think it's huge. You know, it's just unreal to see what she's done being so young, especially at UConn, because that's not normal to be young at UConn and be that successful. Like, it just doesn't happen, right? It's just not how it works. So, but the thing I love about Paige is she's such a good person, like off the court. And she uses her platform really well, I think. And she's a special player that doesn't come around that often, but she's level-headed enough where she's such a great role model for a lot of girls coming up. Because now we do a lot of like camps and clinics and things. And one thing that's very clear is that a lot of young girls don't know basketball, right? And not just how to play, but who's playing and who came before them. So I think Paige is someone that has gotten so much attention and that is so popular that she's someone that can kind of, you know, get those younger kids really interested in learning more about, you know, those players that are like Paige. They're going to kind of pave the way for them.
Your thoughts on the new NIL law where college athletes are now able to make money off their own marketing and also their licensing and their branding?
I'm kind of conflicted with that. I think it's great because I think when I was back in college, I was like, oh, that would have been awesome to be able to make some extra money and not be like a broke college student. But on the other side of that, that's like, it's for a very small percentage of players that are actually going to get those deals. So for those ones that don't, it's kind of like, well, you might have a player that's making hundreds of thousands of dollars on your team, another player that's the typical broke college student that is struggling. So I think it's a good thing. But then I also think if with that, there should be some type of like financial literacy training, dealing with family members, how to deal with your money, you know, taxes, all types of things. I think that can become problems when you're between 18 and 22 making a lot of money when you have no idea what to do with it. So I think it's a good thing, but I think it also can be a bad thing at the same time.
Well, do you think it's going to help those like Paige Beckers who already has a deal?
Yeah, and she actually has a few really good ones. I think it's great for her because for players like her, right, it's not going to be that many that are going to get those type of deals, but for those, there shouldn't be any reason why you can't make money off yourself. right? Like, or even you look at AZ Fudd that's on UConn, she's in a TikTok commercial that I see on TV all the time, you know? So it's crazy to think, just because like it wasn't obviously that long ago where you couldn't do that. But I think if it's a way that you can start, you know, setting yourself up financially, especially for women's players, because, you know, even though most of us, you play WNBA, play overseas, but most of us, besides a very select few, are going to have to get jobs after they're done playing. So if there's a way that you can kind of start that entrepreneurial path, I think you should, no problem.
She's the director of franchise development for the Connecticut Sun and a UConn alumnus, a WNBA champion, four-time national champion, Morgan Tuck. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
Have you read any works written by people who have been incarcerated? And do you think athletes should use their platforms to promote equity and social justice? Let us know what you think. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org, and we're on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU. That's it for our program today. Produced by Fatu Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.